I'd like to take a step back for a second, both in time to talk about one of your past books and also to talking about the DSM in and of itself. Okay, your book, They Say You're Crazy, focuses on the disingenuous and dishonest process of constructing the world's most influential handbook of mental disorders, the DSM-4. The American Psychiatric Association is the publisher of the DSM, and the book itself holds tons of political weight and, like you mentioned, generates tons of income. Could you explain the extent of the wealth generated by this book, by the DSM?
Well, it's in the millions. It's way up into the millions. When the DSM-3R came out in 1987, there was some information available showing that it had been translated into at least 17 different languages and was being sold in all these many countries. I'm sure that it's been translated into far more now. You're now hearing about many children in China being diagnosed with attention deficit disorder. Nobody in China ever knew this existed before. And so what's happening is there's a kind of simultaneous creep of the DSM and the drug company influence into countries all over the world. It's the globalization, it's the exporting of psychiatric diagnosis and of the psychiatrizing of everything. So every time a new edition comes out, libraries, mental health professionals, training programs, hospitals, clinics have to get the new edition of the DSM. And of course, there are the updated case books and source books and audio tapes and videotapes and CD-ROMs and so on. So it's a multi-million dollar business. And part of what's so problematic about that, I mean, if you just said, well, they take this money and they do good works with it, you know, then I wouldn't be quite so worried. But let's face it, the American Psychiatric Association is a lobby group. Lots of people don't know that. When I wrote a play about this called Call Me Crazy, one of the things that I had one of the characters say is, but the American Psychiatric Association, they care about people. They wouldn't lie about anything, would they? People have the impression that the American Psychiatric Association is there to care about us. And they're not. They're there to protect the business interests and the territory of their members, the psychiatrists. And one of the most appalling aspects of the DSM, as far as I'm concerned, is that they market it as a scientifically grounded document. When I was teaching graduate students at OISE in Toronto, I used to say, I taught it as an advocate. I would hold up the DSM, and I love logic, and they have these decision trees in the back, and I just was almost salivating. I just love teaching this stuff. And I would say, isn't it wonderful? These people have read all the research that's relevant to various kinds of emotional problems, and they've culled through it, obviously, and they must have. They're the APA. And here we have, in this 3-pound book, the product of all of this science. Well, when I was on two of the DSM-4 committees, I resigned in horror because I said the process should be called Diagnosis Gate, because look what they do with the research. When it suits their purposes, they ignore it, they distort it, or they just out and out lie about it. And I used the word lie in that context in They Say You're Crazy. That book was published a decade ago. I tell you, nobody's ever hinted at trying to sue me because they know that it's true. They know I've got it all documented. And so the fact that they know that and they keep doing it anyway, I think is appalling. I have had so many people come to me and talk to me about problems they're having or their child is having, and they describe to me what they've been through. And very often, it's been a long process of going from one professional to another, to another, to another, to try to figure out which diagnostic category does this person match in the DSM. And I sit there and I say to them, you know what? It doesn't really matter, because these diagnoses are not scientifically derived. Even ones that you may think, oh yeah, but autism, I mean, they know what autism is, don't they? Well, you ask different experts on autism and you will get different lists of criteria. The same thing with schizophrenia, the same thing with many of the categories in there. And so what people need to understand is that mental illness itself is, psychologists talk about constructs all the time. So mental illness is a construct, meaning it's not any more real like a table than is love or intelligence. And if you asked five people on the street to define love or intelligence, you get five different answers because it isn't a real thing. And mental illness is the same. The DSM authors even said quite publicly they had one heck of a time trying to come up with an acceptable definition of mental disorder. And when you look at the one that they chose, it's not very good. You could drive a truck through the loopholes in it. And so given that this overall category of mental illness is itself just a construct, then of course every category within it and every subcategory is a construct too. And one of the chapters in the new book, In Bias and Psychiatric Diagnosis, is by Jeffrey Poland and me. And Jeffrey Poland is a clinical psychologist. He knows about the history of psychology and philosophy of psychology and science. He's brilliant. And one of the things that he has written about, he also writes about it in a chapter of his own in the book about schizophrenia. And let me use that as an example. He says, first of all, you take any two people who've both been diagnosed as schizophrenic, even using the DSM, they will probably not have identical symptoms. They will probably not meet all the same criteria as each other, all right? So what does it tell us that they're both diagnosed with schizophrenia? Maybe they both have hallucinations, but then what do we do with that given that their other criteria are different from each other and, even more importantly, given that they are different people? And what Jeffrey Poland says is, all too often these days, patient comes in to see a therapist and the therapist gets out the DSM and immediately they're trying to figure out which description in the DSM does this person match. Now, there are certain standard questions in taking a history that everybody is supposed to ask, but time gets shorter and shorter these days. You know, you can spend less and less time with patients. And I have heard psychiatrists in particular boast they can diagnose a patient in 10 minutes or in 40 minutes. Now, you can't get to know somebody well enough to give them a diagnosis, for goodness sake, in that short a time. But what's happening is they're just trying to figure out which set of criteria in the DSM does this person match. And that means they're not asking enormously important questions about who are you, what strengths do you have, as well as what problems, what resources are available to you, how do you think about things, what do you want? And so what you end up doing then, all too often, is you give a fast diagnosis and then you're treating the diagnosis instead of the person.
What kind of political power does the DSM have?
It has terrifying political power. And I think it's important to say that that is true in Canada as well as in the United States. And I know that we Canadians sometimes like to say, well, if something's American, we don't have to follow it. We don't have to think it's good. And I think one of the tragedies in Canada in this respect is that the DSM is the Bible there, just as it is in the United States and a lot of other countries now. And I had been hoping that the Canadian Psychiatric Association would rise up in arms and say, we can't have this anymore, but unfortunately they're not. There are so many ways in which people's lives can be destroyed and have been destroyed just because of getting a psychiatric diagnosis. On a large political scale, one of the effects of the DSM is that it takes so many major social problems and leads us to look at the people who are harmed by these social problems, violence, poverty, homophobia, racism, ageism, sexism, ableism, and so on. We look at the people who have been harmed by these awful social forces, and then we say, oh, look, he's depressed. She's anxious. So we diagnose you as having major depressive disorder and her as having generalized anxiety disorder. And so on this grand political scale, it is very powerful in pushing us to ignore major social problems. We take the results of them and we set them apart and we say, okay, these persons have psychiatric illnesses. We medicalize them. There are things in the DSM that by no stretch of the imagination are mental disorders, such as stuttering. But it's the manual of mental disorders. Stuttering is in there with one of the numbers, the category numbers, like they all have. Math disability is in there as a mental disorder. And then there are other categories that take something that is painful, but treat it as a psychiatric problem instead of a part of life. So for example, if you lose somebody close to you and you're still grieving 2 months later, you have major depressive disorder, according to the DSM. So there's no such thing as normal feelings and normal reactions anymore. And the difficulty with that, and I see this as very political too, because it really is oppressive to people. If you come in to see a therapist because you're grieving and you're just so sad and you just want to talk to somebody about it, you figure your friends are sick of hearing it, and I think you should be sent back to your friends and they should be told that's what friends should do. But if you go to see a therapist, say you're in a new city or something, you don't have any friends. If you go to see a therapist because you're grieving and you've been grieving for 2.5 months, you walk in there with one problem, which is that you're profoundly sad. You walk out with a second one, you're mentally ill. Oh, gee, I didn't know that. I got that too now. And the message is very clearly, you have major depressive disorder. You should have been over this by now. Otherwise, why would we have this 2-month cutoff point? Now, after sitting in meetings with these members of these DSM committees and hearing them have discussions that go like this, so let's see this disorder, let's see, how long should they have been experiencing these symptoms before we say they've got the disorder? Somebody will say, I think 6 weeks, and somebody else will say, I say 10 weeks. They look around, call it 8. That's the way these so-called scientific decisions are being made. Now, if the title were not Diagnostic and Statistical Manual of Mental Disorders, and if it didn't have this whole aura of scientific precision that surrounds it with all of the numbers of the categories and the lists of criteria, if they just called it a book with a bunch of labels, most of which have no bearing on science, and that about a dozen mostly white, mostly male, mostly American psychiatrists threw together to just sort of have a common language, if that were the title, I would say okay. But that's not the title. And so you've got entire mental health systems, you've got entire countries operating on the assumption that we're dealing here with science, we're dealing with therapists who are objectively diagnosing people. And meanwhile, people are often suffering harm because of being diagnosed. The drug companies are making billions and billions of dollars and gigantic profit margins. And meanwhile, maybe what the person needs really is not even being addressed. Now, in another sense that's political, we've got this... I have trouble talking about it. Jeffrey Poland and I wrote a chapter about it in the book called The Deep Structure of Bias. And we're trying to talk about what keeps this going. And it was very hard to write about, and it's hard to talk about because there are so many different systems, and each one affects all of the others. They're so intertwined. You want to sort of talk about them all simultaneously, and you can't do that. So It includes the drug companies, the American Psychiatric Association, and so both of them make big profits. It includes the government, whether it's in Canada or the U.S. or elsewhere, the government insofar as it deals with health care. So if it's government-funded health insurance, or if it's government standards about who should get what kind of health care, all of these are government matters. And governments like to have simple ways to deal with things, and so do insurance companies. And, you know, they'll say, but if we don't use the DSM, how are we going to decide whose therapy gets paid for? So there's a lot of resistance from government. And then there's the fact that we live in such a technology kind of oriented society that we're used, as a populace, we're used to getting quick and sort of physical solutions to things. So I'm working 60 hours a week, and I'll lose my job if I don't. And so I'm really feeling awful, but can you give me a pill for this? It's much easier if we don't have time to grapple with the problem some other way, or if we don't have support in our lives for doing that. I mean, nobody should have to do that alone, to struggle with emotional pain and fear and anguish. Mm-hmm. So that is another factor that contributes to the psychiatrizing of everything, which is what it's coming down to.
On that note, I'd like to ask, what are your thoughts on the biological basis of mental illness, in contrast to Thomas Szasz's position that that ideology is the medicalization of people's problems in living?
I think that what Thomas Szasz said about how we shouldn't medicalize problems in living, he's absolutely right. And he was probably the first person to say that in a very public, very clear-thinking way. But there are a lot of people who are experiencing enormous pain, and it's not because of problems in living. It's not because of, well, that's just an ordinary part of life. I mean, I remember as a woman, I remember when we used to, before there was a term sexual harassment, when it happened to us, we just thought this is part of being a woman. We thought that was a problem in living, but it shouldn't be labeled that way. So all kinds of oppression and violence and poverty, all of those factors, they should not be seen as problems in living. They are social and political evils, and they need to be labeled in that way. I see a lot of people around me who are suffering enormously because of having lived with people who are abusive or living with them now. That should not be called a problem in living. But nor are any of those kinds of conditions or difficulties biologically based. Their origin is not biological. And the danger with this hefty tome, the DSM, is that everything gets treated as though it had a biological basis. If you are given a DSM diagnosis, you are much more likely to be put on medication. Now, some people are helped by medication, other people are hurt by medication. But the point is that there is not a lot of variety in what's likely to be recommended to you if you go to see a therapist these days. In the chapter that Jeffrey Poland and I wrote about the deep structure of bias, one of the things we talked about was this cause-effect problem in thinking. And it goes like this. I was feeling depressed. I took an antidepressant. I feel better. Antidepressants change your brain chemistry. Therefore, since I feel better now, it must have been that something was wrong with my brain. Well, now, anybody who's ever been feeling kind of, oh, you know, somebody jilts you, so you go out and get roaring drunk and you feel better. Does that mean that your upset over being jilted had a biological basis? No, of course not. So it's wrong-headed, and it can be dangerous to assume that if a pill makes you feel better temporarily or over the longer term, that the cause of the problem was biological. And let me tell you this example. I remember the first time I ever had a friend who was on, I think it was Zoloft. It was one of the drugs in that family. And I said to her, how come you're taking Zoloft? And she said, well, you know, we have two little girls. And she said, basically, her husband did not want her to have the job that she wanted to have, which was in the arts and which she dearly loved, because he said, you can't make enough money that way. We need the money. And she said to me, Paula, we have so much money, we couldn't possibly spend it all in the rest of our lives if we tried. But he was very controlling, and he was determined that she would not keep the job that she loved. And I said to her, so what does that have to do with the Zoloft? She said, well, as long as we have young children, I can't leave him. And I said, and so you took the Zoloft, and she looked at me and she said, it didn't get rid of my problems, but it allows me to experience them as from a distance. Now, you know, that's a choice she gets to make. I think it's tragic, but really it is up to her to decide, is it going to be worse for the girls if she stays with him when he's being so controlling and unfair, or is it going to be worse to take them away from their father? So nobody should try to tell her what to do, but she should have been offered other kinds of options besides just drugs, whether it's some sort of spirituality, whether it's drumming, whether it's taking an acting class, whether it's getting into a mutual support group or volunteering at a shelter where other women are clearly abused. But almost never are people given the whole range of options, and almost never are people told the full range of, you know, here's what I'm recommending for you, and here's everything I know about the pros and the cons of this. And those are two criteria that should always be met, and they almost never are. And the danger with respect to the DSM is that getting one of those diagnoses makes it even more likely that you'll just be put on drugs.
Mm-hmm. Would you say that's one of the political ramifications of psychotropic drugs, making people tolerate the intolerable in that sense?
Absolutely, absolutely. This woman, I think, should be able to have a bunch of people come in and say to her husband, this is not fair. It's not rational. It's not fair. It's not necessary. And it's emotionally abusive. And it's not a good model for your children to see, because they know what their mom enjoys doing and what she hates doing. That's what should happen. But that's never going to happen if we keep saying, honey, you just keep taking your drugs. And I'll tell you this, too, that, you know, there are times when an individual may feel, I am in such excruciating emotional pain right now. I cannot do anything about it myself. I have to get through the workday. I'm supporting my kids. I can't afford to get fired, whatever the reason. Or else just the pain is just too acute right now. I just can't bear it. A very recent loss, maybe. I don't know. And they will say, okay, I'm just going to take some medication just temporarily to get through this. Now, I know people who have been on these drugs, and especially antidepressants, and every single one of them has said to me, you know, it distanced me from my feelings, and they may say, and that was okay for a little while. But then I wanted to start getting rid of the underlying problem. I wanted to work it through, get beyond it. And I found that as long as I was on this drug, I didn't have access to my feelings. They were not very present for me. And only when I went off the medication was I able to make some progress in working out the problems or working through the feelings. Mm-hmm. Now, I should say, I cannot sit here and tell you that I'm sure that there was never anything wrong with anyone's central nervous system that led to them being upset, terrified, imagining scary things that weren't there. Because of course that has happened. I mean, I have people close to me who've had brain damage from accidents, and they have become tormented people. And so, of course, changes in the brain can lead to serious emotional states and problems. But that's much more unusual than you would think if you just look at the DSM,